There's so much to say about Dr. Zeta Elliott because she has so much to say. A Black feminist, writer, and educator born and raised in Canada, Zeta has lived in the United States for more than 20 years, getting her PhD in American Studies from NYU in 2003. In the years since, she's written poetry, plays, essays, novels, children's books. She's also taught at Ohio University, Louisiana State, Mount Holyoke, and Hunter, just to name a few. Her plays have been staged in New York, Cleveland, and Chicago. Her essays have appeared in numerous publications, as has her poetry. Zeta has been on the receiving end of honors and awards for her books. Ship of Souls, published in 2012, was named a book list top 10 sci-fi fantasy title for youth. Her children's books also include Room in My Heart, about a little girl trying to adjust to her parents' divorce. It was named a Best Children's Book of the Year by Bank Street College of Education. The picture book Bird tells the story of a family coping with addiction. It won the Honor Award in Lee and Lowe's Books New Voice Contest and the Patterson Prize for Books for Young Readers. There's also A Wave Came Through Our Window, Last Bunny in Brooklyn, and The Girl Who Swallowed the Sun. Her books for adults include Stranger in the Family, which examines the shifting terrain upon which we negotiate race, kinship, and identity. Zeta, a tireless and outspoken advocate for greater diversity and equity in publishing, has her own imprint, Rosetta Press. Since 2013, she has self-published 10 books for young readers. So there's so much to talk about. Let's meet Dr. Zeta Elliott. Welcome and thanks so much for joining me today.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me, Sandy.
So growing up in Canada, what was that like? Tell us about your childhood.
My childhood. I have to say, I had a very happy childhood for the first approximately 6 years. I was living in Pickering, which is east of Toronto, and it was a semi-rural area that was being turned into subdivisions. So you would have a house and then a big open field and then another house and another big open field and then maybe a cluster of houses, no sidewalks. Our backyard was huge. My father took our wartime bungalow and turned it into a two-story house by himself. He built it. We had so many fruit trees and flowers, and I mean, it was kind of a paradise for a child. So you could run through a field and come out covered in burrs, and in the wintertime, you could go tobogganing and stay out until after dark. So I really have a lot of happy memories of my childhood in Canada. And then my family, can say, reconfigured.
Okay.
And I had an older adopted brother who was returned to his birth parents when I was six, and that was pretty traumatic. And
just then, out of nowhere?
It wasn't. So he was actually my father's first cousin. And my father is Caribbean.
Mm-hmm.
So my father came up from the Caribbean when he was a teenager. And there's kind of a tradition within the Caribbean that you bring up your relatives. And so my father didn't have siblings to be brought up, but his aunt had, I think, 8 or 9 kids.
Mm-hmm.
And Denzel was one of the youngest. And my parents went to Nevis in the Caribbean, where
my
father's from, for a vacation. And my mother apparently fell in love with little Denzel. And since there were so many kids in the family and they were struggling, the idea was bring him to Canada, get him educated, you know, kind of that narrative of progress that really didn't work out because, as you probably know, international adoptions can be very, very
difficult.
Well,
was he actually adopted or was he just...
He was officially adopted, yeah.
And how old were you when Denzel came to you?
I was 2.
You were 2.
So I was 2 and he was 6 when he arrived. And
okay.
Can you believe they brought him on Halloween night? So just imagine...
Oh, my gosh.
We have this picture of, like, me with a mask and my sister with her costume, big smile, and then my brother, like, pulling off his mask, like, what in God's name is this? So it was a really, really difficult time for him. So he basically lasted 4 years in Canada and ran away frequently and was getting nosebleeds. And it was just a disaster. And so
The culture shock must have been so huge.
And then culturally, you know, my father was raised in the Caribbean by his grandmothers and, you know, spare the rod, spoil the child.
Mm-hmm.
So he was actually seriously physically abused by one of his aunts and continued that when my brother came up. And my mother, it's so complicated, but my family comes from a devout Christian, I can't call it a sect, denomination, the Pilgrim Holiness Church. And it's very patriarchal. And my mother grew up believing that men determine what happens in the home. And so she didn't say anything. And then, you know, they ultimately, I think some other family members stepped in and said, it's time for Denzel to go back. He is the basis for my picture book, Bird, because he went back to Nevis and had a pretty difficult life there. and didn't get probably the therapy that he needed, and ended up starting to drink at a very early age and became an alcoholic by the time he was a teenager. And then my dad brought him back. And by that point, my parents had divorced. My dad was married to someone else and had two more kids. And once again, just kind of plunked my brother into this world that was a little bit familiar, but not really.
Did you have a continuing relationship with Denzel?
So not in the years that he was back in the Caribbean.
Right,
not
but when
all.
He came back.
When he came back, I was just thrilled because I had always been the baby of the family and he always looked out for me. He was a really sweet kid. And my older sister was kind of not that interested, but my brother always looked out for me. And so, yeah, I was super excited when he came back and begged him. I was about to head off to college, begged him to move in with my mother. Because he was living with my father. And I said, could you come live with mom? Because I don't want her to be alone. And I have a cat. And would you take care of my cat? And he was like, yeah, sure. He was really great. But then, you know, I would come home for vacation from college. And it was clear that he was having problems. And he was drinking. And then things started disappearing from our house. And, yeah, he ended up being arrested for theft and identity fraud. And it was clear that there was some kind of addiction. I don't know if the alcoholism, you know, was something that eventually led to drug addiction. I never saw him use drugs. But Bird essentially is a picture book is for older kids because it does deal with a little boy who doesn't understand what's happening to his older brother and why his older brother starts stealing from the family.
And winds up on this very slippery slope.
And gets locked out of their home, which is essentially what we did. So I haven't spoken to my brother since 1998.
Wow.
Yeah.
Do you know where he is?
I have a basic sense. I think he's in the Canadian Midwest in Manitoba.
Uh-huh.
And he had a child, a son, with a First Nations woman who was living on a reservation. So I assume that my nephew is living on a reservation as well in Canada. And, you know, my brother was an alcoholic. The last time I talked to him, he said she had a restraining order. But we heard he was driving a truck, so they don't let alcoholics drive trucks, I don't think.
So maybe
things
got turned around.
I'm hoping there was some rehab in there somewhere. And
so here you are, a young girl who has a lot of drama in her life.
Yeah.
And that must have been a very hard thing to reconcile even at that age. So is it presumptuous of me to think that you found solace in books?
So I absolutely found sanctuary in books. Books were an escape. And my mother, who is not a prime communicator and practices denial pretty frequently, you know, after the divorce, she would basically come home, go upstairs, open a book, and she was done for the day.
So that was her form of escapism.
That was her form of coping, was to disappear, and she read historical fiction. She loved Katherine Cookson. And then she started to take a college course in British literature in, I think, 1985, and had her second major stroke. And so she had to drop the course, but all of her books were there in the house. And so I
picked the taking,
yeah, there
huh?
you go. So at 12, I was reading Jane Austen and Oliver Twist and George Eliot and a whole bunch of others.
Let's call this, you were very much ahead of your time.
So I,
so you
know,
were pretty advanced.
My sister and I were advanced students, and we both skipped a grade when we were 5 or 6 years old. So, yeah, school had always been something that we enjoyed and
a
where
refuge
we excelled.
Too?
Yeah, because our parents, strangely enough, both my parents are school teachers, but they weren't really invested in our academic life. And so we got praise from our teachers. I always had support and I always had people encouraging me to write. And I always told stories, which I can see now was also a coping mechanism to deal with some of the trauma in my family. But I always had a lot of support at school and I could be closer to my true self at school. I wasn't outgoing, but I was outspoken, and I got a lot of respect for my opinions and for the stances that I took on
certain
issues.
So there was encouragement.
Absolutely, whereas there was pretty much silence at home and or mockery in some cases. So
how'd you reconcile the two? Isn't that living a bit of a schizophrenic life?
I mean, I guess what you learn to code switch. So you have certain skills that you apply. So when I'm at home, I learned how to be invisible. And that has served me.
And not make waves?
Exactly. How to not be noticed so that nobody picks on you or says anything terrible about you. And then when you're at school, how to stand out so that people do notice you and notice you for the things you want to be noticed for. So in my family, my sister's the pretty one and I was the athletic one. So, you know, doing track and field, I made sure I excelled. And my father was an athlete and he couldn't get enough of red ribbons and trophies and things like
and
that.
And he was so proud of you?
Yeah. You know, didn't show up for a lot of track meets and baseball games and that sort of thing. And my mother had no interest at all. But again, that was, you know, a way of getting praise and support. And then in high school, I wanted to be more like my sister because she was my dad's favorite and she wore stilettos and skirts to school every day. So I gave that a try, and that meant no more sports and trying to wear makeup and trying to style my hair.
Well, I think wearing stilettos is some kind of a form of a sport person.
She has some calf muscles, I can tell you. But yeah, and then realizing, you know, midway through high school that that was not really who I was. And yeah, so just trying to figure it all out, try to go to college, pick the wrong college, but met some really good friends. And then after college, my dad said, you know, I'm living in Brooklyn now. Do you want to come down? And I just fell in love with Brooklyn.
So you dumped Canada.
I sure did, and did not look back and have no regrets.
If you're just joining us, my guest today is Dr. Zeta Elliott, who happens to be a feminist writer and educator. So you go to school in Canada, and then you come to the United States.
Yeah.
And you apply to NYU. Was that basically the trajectory? And American studies, huh?
Yeah. So I had kind of a transition year, and I came down and spent a year at Brooklyn College. And I thought I could apply and register, and was told by a very unpleasant elderly person in the admissions office that I would never be able to register because I had an in-between visa situation where we had applied for permanent residency, but I didn't have my green card. And ultimately, that took, I think, 8 or 9 years before
wow.
I got my green card.
Wow.
Yeah. So in the meantime, I was not an international student because I didn't have that kind of visa, but I didn't have any papers really that said, except a letter that said, your application is pending. So they let me, the Africana department at Brooklyn College, let me be a research assistant, and I helped out some professors, and in exchange got to take classes. So that was my first time really taking Black Studies classes. And my stepsister had a room full, like just a wall of African American literature, and I just went book by book by book, and I read everything I could get my hands on. And that really sort of set me on the course where I knew I wanted to. I felt like I needed to do another undergraduate degree, so I applied to Columbia and I got in, and one of my former professors was like, what are you doing? You don't do another BA. You do graduate school. Get a PhD. And I had never thought about that at all. But my sister happened to be studying for the GRE, and she said, you have to take the GRE to get into graduate school. So I got that phone book-sized study guide and took the GRE and only wanted to be in New York, so applied to Columbia and NYU and got into both and talked to professors there, and NYU was just a perfect fit for me. For the first time, I had Black professors, and they were incredible scholars and incredible teachers. And my cohort was huge. We had 20 people coming in, and more than half of them were Black. So it was this really extraordinary moment for me, having lived in a majority white environment my whole life and had to fight for a certain kind of recognition. And then to come down here, and the recognition is based on different things, because if most of us are Black, then we don't have to really talk about race that much, but we might have to talk about color, and we probably have to talk about class, and then we need to talk about ethnicity, and obviously immigration status was an issue for me. And I wasn't that invested in being an academic. I didn't want to be a scholar. I was working with kids. I've worked with kids for 25 years, and I love teaching children, and it was hard to be studying Marxist theory and then go into, you know, Bed-Stuy and run an after-school program for kids, and how do you make that relevant? So that's sort of what ultimately led me to writing for kids, was wanting to take the material from my dissertation on representations of racial violence in African-American literature and somehow make that relevant to kids who are sick of Black history. And every February, they just roll their eyes like, here we go again, because of the way it's taught.
Sure.
It's like, okay, another biography of Martin Luther King and
right.
Rosa Parks.
Sure.
And now we're going to move on.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You were writing stories way back.
Yeah.
But when did it become this epiphany that, hold on a minute here, I've got something to say that I have to get out, and it's really important, and also other people don't have my voice?
Yeah, I think when I came to NYU, that was the first time I was with a group of Black women who all identified as writers, and I had never identified as a writer. I think people who knew me knew that I wrote, but I would never walk up to anyone and say, hi, I'm Zeta, I'm a writer.
Right.
And they all did. They would just all talk about how they were poets and playwrights, and I would be like, do you have a book? And they'd be like, no. I'm like, are you allowed to say you're a writer when you don't have a book? And they were like, of course you can. So I got some confidence from my friends. And then I also had someone to read my work. And so I had, you know, Black women, Black feminists who were looking at my work. And I remember one friend of mine, Gabrielle, she said, oh, your voice is so formal. God, you're so British. And I was horrified. And I thought, oh, my God. She's like, you're almost like, you write like Dickens. And I just, you know, like 5 years ago before that, I would have been so thrilled if anyone compared me to Dickens.
Sure.
But I was mortified. So I became very self-conscious and tried to make my writing voice, my creative writing voice, more relaxed. But it was challenging because I was writing, you know, theoretical scholarly work. So I quit graduate school for a year in 1998, and I wrote my first novel, When I Open.
How'd you have the nerve?
You know, I had always been ambivalent about the Academy, and I was fortunate that I had a full scholarship. So I basically, you know, my director, Andrew Ross, he always knew that I was ambivalent. And when I went to him and said, you know what, I've had it. I'm really done with this. And he said, why don't you take a year off and go do some research in Canada and we'll hold your funding, mm-hmm. which was such a gracious thing for him to do. So once I finished the novel, I had to think about what I was going to do next. And I had agents and editors writing me and they wanted to see the manuscript. And I thought, oh, it's going to happen. So I'll just go back to graduate school because that's where I get my paycheck. And I'll finish my degree. And in the meantime, I'll probably get some six-figure advance. And then I'll be on my way to
Dream
be a writer.
On,
there you go, right?
How did you think you could pull off writing a novel?
I think when you've been reading all your life.
It just seems to be a no-brainer in a way?
Yeah. Well, not a no-brainer necessarily, but I think at the time that I started writing When I Open, I was already writing short vignettes, almost like what today would probably result in a web series.
Mm.
So I had these characters and they were having these interactions and they weren't in any way connected. So I just felt like all I had to do was take those same characters and create some kind of overarching theme or narrative that would pull it all together. And I always tell people that writing for me is 70% dreaming. So if you've spent enough time dreaming, by the time I sit down, so this latest book I just published, Deshaun's Gift, it's a 10,000-word time travel novel, and I wrote it in a month.
Because it just poured out of you?
Because I was ready, because I've been writing about the New York City draft riots in 1863 for over a decade, and I had just been writer-in-residence at Weeksville Heritage Center, and the book is set in Weeksville. So when you're immersed in the period and you have an understanding of the subject, and like I said, I work with kids a lot. So once you have a basic sense of the narrative, you're just, it's almost like filling in the blanks for me. So One Eye Open is not my best work, and I never did find a publisher for it. Mm-hmm. And I ultimately self-published it and just quietly keep it on my website. Just a friend just bought a copy yesterday, and I was like, watch out now, because there's some really beautifully written passages. But I've learned a lot on how to be not just a good writer, but a good storyteller. That's almost more important for me now, is how to tell a good story.
And at what point did you realize that you wanted to communicate with children?
So because I was always working with kids, I felt as though that was always going to be a part of my life. I would always teach in some way. But I was teaching at the Frederick Douglass Creative Arts Center in 2000, and it was right after I'd had that disappointing, oh, all this excitement about One Eye Open and then nothing.
Mm.
Silence. Mm. And for 6 months, I didn't write. Oh, I can't even believe that now.
Was it kind of, I'm taking my marbles and going home?
It was like, I'm just going to wait for this to happen. And, you know, maybe I tinkered a bit on One Eye Open, but I wasn't going to start anything new because this is going to happen.
Yeah.
And I was teaching at the Frederick Douglass Creative Arts Center, teaching creative writing to kids. And every time we started a new genre, I would do an example. So we were doing children's books, and I made a dummy children's book and showed it to them, and they loved it. And that was Room in My Heart, which was based on my experience with my parents' divorce. And then I had a little girl in that class who would come in after school and throw her bag across the room and knock a chair over and hit her one and only friend. And I took her aside and was like, what is wrong with you? And she was getting into fights at school every day. And she said, well, the kids tease me and they call me jailbird because my mom's in prison.
Mm.
And I went to every bookstore I could find to get a book for her about a little girl who has a mother in prison.
And guess what you found?
There you go. So there were no mirrors. No mirror books for the kids.
Yeah, you talk about that. You never, and other children just never saw themselves on the page.
And it's devastating. It's an essay by Rudine Sims Bishop, and she talks about mirrors, windows, and sliding glass doors. So if you have a book that's a mirror, it's showing you a reflection of yourself. So for most of the kids that I work with, black and brown, black and Latino, they're living in low-income neighborhoods. A lot of them are immigrants or children of immigrants. If they don't have books that reflect their reality, then they're reading books that are windows, that let them look into other people's worlds. And there's nothing wrong with that. I grew up reading those books. But if you only see white children having wonderful adventures in a castle in England, that is sending you an implicit message about your neighborhood. and about your community and about you.
Mm.
And so I really
wanted. You don't exist.
Exactly. It's a kind of erasure. We call it symbolic annihilation.
Huh.
So you have the actual extermination of black children like Tamir Rice, you know, shot on site in Cleveland. And then you have this more kind of insidious symbolic annihilation where the reason people don't think black children are innocent, are capable of innocence, is in part because they're never represented as such. And how do we get this notion that children are innocent? Well, it's from the images we see in film and on TV and primarily in books. So it's frustrating to me that only 2% of published authors in the U.S., children's book authors, are African-American. But it is not surprising to me because only 1% of publishing professionals are African-American. So you have a publishing industry that is over 90% white, producing books for kids that are over 90% white. And right now, more than half of primary school-aged children in the U.S. are kids of color. And that number is only going to continue to increase. So we have to ask ourselves, who's really interested in empowering which children in this country? And I have a personal mandate to do for kids what wasn't done for me. I had Ezra Jack Keats. If I hadn't had his books, thank God, you know, white Jewish man from Brooklyn who wrote, you know, The Snowy Day, one of the very first books to have black children where they weren't racist caricatures. If I hadn't had those books, I would have had nothing. And when I started to write for kids, my first picture book story I wrote in high school, I wrote about a white family. That's what ends up happening. I have kids come up to me all the time, beautiful black and brown kids who want to show me their book, and it's full of blonde-haired, blue-eyed children.
It's nuts.
It is. It's really just, it's bizarre, but it's also, it's heartbreaking. And I just think I can do something about that.
If you're just joining us, my guest today is Dr. Zeta Elliott, who happens to be a feminist writer and educator. I want to quote you. I believe a writer can make a profound intervention in a child's understanding and experience in the world, and the world for children is often a very small sphere, occupied only by their family, friends, and neighbors. Too often, however, they, children, lack the language and or the opportunity to articulate their wide range of emotions and keen observations. I see my work as a change to fill that void.
Yeah, it really is, because I think about my family. I was a teenager when my brother went through, was incarcerated, but, you know, my mother just would not talk about it. And I said, you know, Denzel took the microwave. Denzel took, you know, identity theft. He's opened up. I mean, I just kept pointing out things to her and she just would not talk about it. Probably because she felt guilty around what happened when he was
a child. Well, it's very complicated.
It is complicated. It is. But, you know, if I had been an 8-year-old boy when that was happening and my beloved older brother was just disappearing and turning into someone I didn't recognize, the answer is not silence.
Of course.
Because children are so observant. They notice everything. Right? They notice everything. And then if you're not creating a narrative that they can participate in, they're going to create their own narrative. And they're probably going to draw from what they're seeing in the world around them, which for children of color is not a lot of positivity.
But come on, Zeta, writing books for children of color on some level seems to be a no-brainer. You had to make that discovery?
Well, I mean, so we have scholars. So for African Americans, right now we have the We Need Diverse Books movement. I don't know if you've heard about
that. I haven't.
But it's this big movement that started last year, and they have the hashtag, and they've incorporated, and they're doing all these sort of events and things to raise awareness about the need for diverse books. And they have a huge following. They've done a fantastic job mobilizing people. But they aren't making any demands of the publishing industry. So if you aren't holding anyone accountable, then how are you going to create change? And African Americans, they've had a hard time getting African American women on board, in part because African Americans have a century-long history of fighting for fair representation of their children. We know how dangerous it can be to either have your child erased from the official record and or to have the distortion. I'm writing about a Brooklyn Eagle reporter right now who went to a black baseball game.
Brooklyn Eagle is a paper,
a newspaper? Yep. And it was 1862, and he wanted to see these black baseball teams, the Brooklyn Monitors, playing the Weeksville Unknowns. And he started talking about the people in the crowd, the pickaninnies. And, I mean, he's using all kinds of racist language, and it's clearly just hilarious to him to think that black people could be competing and playing America's path. I mean, it's just, it's appalling. And so, to me, when I'm writing that scene, I'm writing how glorious this autumn afternoon is for this community to be in a safe place, to not have to fear white hostility or violence. And they're playing this game and they're having this competition and all this enthusiasm and exhilaration. And then here's this white reporter in the midst of it, you know, scribbling down notes and laughing and mocking and smirking. And then his record becomes the only record we have of that game.
Mm.
Yeah.
And because of that, that's also one of the reasons why you said you self-publish.
I do. So I spent, you know, a decade sending out my manuscripts, and I would get letters from editors.
How wonderful
is quite,
you are, but
you write beautifully, but there's no market for this. It's so interesting.
So they determined.
To me. Or it's not right for our list, which to me is the exact same thing as states' rights. So you can say we're having this movement that's nationwide. We may even have legislation. And then a state will say, well, if that's not right for us, we're going to vote on it.
Right, right.
You don't vote on people's civil rights. Not where I come from. Not
Hello.
In Canada.
Mm-hmm.
But this idea that someone, I mean, I had just had an editor. She went through 8 of my manuscripts and wrote annotated rejections for each of them. I really enjoyed this. Back to School is the kind of book we're definitely looking for, but there's a little too much dialogue. But I really enjoyed it. Just rejection after rejection. This is so beautifully written. I got shivers up and down my spine reading this, but it's not right for our list. So
what do you do with that?
You self-publish. You tell yourself, they're not saying I'm a bad writer. And then I found the statistics compiled annually by the Cooperative Children's Book Center, CCBC. They're based out of the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and K.T. Horning is the director. And every year they review close to 4,000 books for kids. And then they break it down by race. So what you see is that there are about 2% books are by African-Americans. So they'll actually do a chart that shows you the number of books by African-Americans, about African-Americans, by but not about. And they'll do that for Asian Pacific Americans, Native Americans, and Latinos. They need to do it for whites too, but they're not doing that yet. And what you see is that we might have 60 books by African Americans in 1 year, but we'll have 180 books about African Americans.
Uh-huh.
So if only 60 of those books are by African Americans, that means the majority of books being written about Black people are written by people who aren't Black. So you have white authors who are increasing the diversity without increasing the equity.
Oh, that's
you have
great...
more diverse books, but you have the same exact people being given the
Isn't
opportunity to tell
nuts.
The story. It is. It's extremely frustrating.
I want you to talk a little bit about your birthday party pledge.
So one of the challenges around promoting diverse books is that publishers will say, well, we would love to publish more, but they don't sell. And of course, the truth is they don't market them to anyone, but they certainly don't market them to people of color. And African-Americans have over $1 trillion in buying power. African-American women buy the most books of any group in the country.
Seriously?
Seriously. So we have this myth that Black people don't read. We have this actual true story coming out of schools where teachers say, you know, Black boys stop reading around middle school. Well, if they had books that reflected them, I bet they would keep on reading.
I mean,
it's just circular.
It's such a no-brainer.
It is.
It gives me a headache. Yeah, go ahead.
It is. So a few friends and I were trying to think of something we could do, and I'm really invested in home libraries. I grew up not having many books in the home. I didn't own books. My mother comes from a family of 9. She still, to this day, she'll buy one book and her siblings will pass it amongst themselves for a year. But studies show that if you have books in the home, you will stay in school longer. You will do better in school. Kids who have books in the home tend to have better vocabulary.
I was just going to say,
because
yes.
Even if the parents aren't reading the books, if they're buying books and valuing them and displaying them in the home, then there's clearly an investment in literacy. So I'm interested in having home libraries. And in order to have home libraries, you have to make parents aware of the importance of them. And you have to let them know where to find those books. Right now, if you went to Barnes & Noble, you would be hard-pressed to find any books about kids of color. Never mind, by people of color.
Good Lord.
So if you're going to be ordering a book, either through a bookstore or online, you have to know the titles, right? You have to be able to say, I want this book, and this book. So we created the Birthday Party Pledge. And we asked people for 1 year, instead of buying plastic toys that will just end up creating a huge carbon footprint, buy books and buy multicultural books. Buy diverse books.
Regardless of who you are.
Regardless of who you are or who the gift is for, give diverse books for a year. And then we give people, I think we have about 10 different categories. So if you want historical fiction, global fiction, sports books, LGBTQ books, science fiction, fantasy, and all of the books in all of those categories feature kids of color. And almost all of them are by people of color. And so the Birthday Party Pledge is a really great site where you can just go if you have no idea how to begin looking for or thinking about diverse lit. It's a good way to find a book that's appropriate for the age of the child and the interests of the child.
How do we get your books?
My books are available on my website, zettaelliott.com, and they're available at a not-for-profit online web store, Teaching for Change. You can get them. I publish through CreateSpace, which is owned by Amazon, so they're on Amazon's global websites. You can buy them there. I am also distributed through Baker & Taylor and Ingram, and that means that any bookstore can and order my books.
It was so my pleasure to get to know you and
meet
you.
And it's been lovely.
And just keep writing, please.
Oh,
and
I will.
Keep advocating. It's just...
It's a compulsion.
And a wonderful compulsion. The world needs more Zeta Elliott.
Thank you, Sandy.
Thank you so much for joining me today.
It's been a pleasure.
Join us for another edition of Conversations with Creative Women. I'm Sandy Klein.